You are listening to a Blazing Caribou Studios production.
Good morning, everybody. This is Victoria, your dog guru, and today we have updates, pupdates, and the why behind your canine. So, first update, I am still giving you a kind of raw cut today because my arm is still in a cast, so I do apologize if this isn't as clean and clear as you're used to, but I will be removing this cast in another 2 weeks, and it looks like I won't need surgery after all, which is excellent news. So just bear with me. We're only 2 more weeks, and I'll be good as new and editing just the way I used to, so... For those of you who are just listening now, if you haven't checked it out already, please check out blazingcariboustudios.com. I really want to make note of this. We have a lot of amazing shows on this network, and I'd like you to have a listen to some of them. So go check out Blazing Caribou Studios. There's new episodes featured every day that you can check out, like Trivia Geeks Live, Two Peas on a Podcast, Varmints is on there, Feast on History. So there's just a ton of shows that you're going to fall in love with. So blazingcariboustudios.com, there's always a link in the show notes. So wherever you're listening to us, you can check it out. Second announcement, if you need help one-on-one with your dog and you would like to speak with me, email me right now at dogguruhereforyou@gmail.com, also in the show notes. And I would be happy to schedule a 60-minute session with you where we can speak one-on-one about your dog, about your individual case, and give you some ideas of what to do next, what could be going on, where you can start on training. So for all of this information and more, please email me. Sessions are 60 minutes long and they're $60 right now. So again, you just email me at dogguruhereforyou@gmail.com. Okay, and the pup date. So Baldur has recently started doing a bit of a 180. If you've listened to earlier episodes, then you know that when I first got this puppy, within the first month, he got violently ill. And for the first, almost year and a half of his life, he's been sick and struggling to keep on weight. He was very delayed in his training as a result because everything revolved around keeping him alive and as healthy as possible. Keeping weight on him was difficult. His coat was not what it was supposed to be. His growth was behind, all of these things. And then, and I mean just over the past month, all of a sudden he just started eating more. I was seeing less accidents. He started overall just appearing healthier. His coat started staying on. It started getting healthier. Now, mind you, nothing significant changed. I was doing the same care plan, the same amount of treatment, the same training. Nothing I did had changed except him. Now, I really wanted to bring this up because a lot of times when we have puppies, we get into situations that may seem unsalvageable. And this dog, when I originally got him, the intent was to make him a service dog. Now, I cannot tell you whether or not he will fully be able to do that job or not. That'll have to be determined once my arm is healed and we have a little bit more time to work on his behaviors more closely. But the important things were already in place. He signaled, he would task, and he's a very intuitive dog, and he's got a very strong work ethic. So for those reasons, I think that he's still a very strong candidate. But everything in our training was delayed. And all of that said, I kept all the training in place. I never really abandoned the process because I don't know, the eternal optimist in me was just thinking, maybe there's hope. Plenty of vets had told me this wasn't going to get better, that if it did get better, it would take at least surgery and probably another $10,000 just to find out exactly what was wrong, with no promise of relief. Now, mind you, this dog you know, had necrotic tissue and all of these other things. I was constantly having to clean him and medicate him and just to keep him to a livable standard. And often I asked myself, is this fair? But this dog had such a strong spirit about him from a young age, and he was just so devoted to me and my family that I was like, I can't just give in and give up. So despite the fact that I knew he probably wasn't going to be a service dog candidate because of his health and the fact that he had constant urination, he would stand and urinate on himself. He had no control. We assumed he had a weak sphincter. We did all the tests that were available that I could afford. And then we ran into, after seeing enough specialists, we just hit a roadblock. And the next bill was going to be over $5,000 or $7,000. And it was just not an option. After all the care that I had given in the first year, I couldn't spend that on top of everything else. So because I do have a family, you know, and I had kind of decided, well, despite the fact he's not going to be a service dog, he may one day just be a good, I mean, I know how to take care of a patient, so I'll just continue taking care of him. And he might not be the dog that I intended for him to be, but he's a good dog. So I had resigned myself in a lot of ways, but continued the training. And I think this is really important to note because basically what I was told is there was no hope. And I had really accepted the fact that he was going to be constant maintenance because I loved him so much. And I saw that there was like a livable status where he was healthier. And I knew if I could, if I gave him to anyone, that they wouldn't invest the time he needed. They would get overwhelmed with the workload he entailed, and it was just not going to work. They would likely have to either give him away themselves or put him down. And I just couldn't face this dog and put him down. Because when you have a dog that's survived an illness so early in life, you know they're a fighter. And so you just don't want to give up on them. So knowing all of the things and the deck being stacked against us, I just accepted certain things and continued on. I went so far into this process, I already started kind of poking around and thinking about service dog prospects in the next, not this year, but the following year, when I felt a little bit more stabilized and more comfortable because I'm grieving the loss of my last dog. And what I realized is last month I was seeing less accidents. And then I noticed he was barking more. And I was like, this is interesting. And every time I would take him out when he barked, he would eliminate. Now, mind you, this dog had signaled to let me know he had to go out before. The difference was is that often he had no idea when he had to go, much like a puppy that's never been potty trained. Although the training was there, and often if he had any sense, he would run to the door and tell us, he had no idea when it was coming and sometimes would be like sleeping and would relieve himself on himself, or he would be standing, getting, you know, waiting for his food and he would urinate. He wasn't necessarily excited during these events. He wouldn't just like pee because someone was coming through the door. So we ran kind of a few scenarios, and what I realized, and this was the biggest indicator that there was a change, was he was starting to put on weight and I was waking up to dry diapers. Now, if you've heard my show, you know I'm not an advocate for dog diapers. To me, it's lazy training in many circumstances. Now, in medical cases, which this was, I felt that it was either that or the dog's life. And being that he was a good dog, I didn't want to cash him in over a diaper. So I was like, if diapers are the worst we have to look at, that's all right. Because all the other training was there and he had a really good heart. Now I'm noticing the diapers are dry in the morning. I'm going, okay, so something is different. He's not urinating on himself at night anymore. And then at first it was just a fluke. And then it was like a couple days together. And then it was a few days. And then it was a an entire week where he was waking up with a dry diaper. And then the next week he started waking me up before the diaper was wet. Now, this was a huge turning point because before he used to bark when he was wet, not before. Like, come on, let me out. My diaper's wet. And I would change. I would take him out and, you know, take off their dirty diaper. And during the day when I was around him, he didn't wear the diaper because I would very closely watch him. But keep in mind, I needed a service animal, and now I was in service to this dog. But I feel like in life, sometimes we're faced with things that are meant to challenge us. And in many ways, this was a very layered situation that I absolutely needed to experience. Not only so I could be more empathetic towards all of you, but because here I was with all the experience in the world, and I couldn't fix this dog. But what happened was interesting. His body started growing. He started retaining weight and essentially grew into himself. And now here we are. I'm a bit in awe, but he's having still less accidents. I'm not saying we're home free yet, but we are seeing a lot less accidents. I see some behaviors that could be deal breakers as far as him being a service dog candidate. But then again, I've worked with a lot of dogs that had behaviors that most people thought couldn't be amended. And not all of them ended up being service dogs, but they ended up being really good dogs. Now, this dog's already a good dog and doesn't have a lot of behavior problems. He's just got impulse control issues largely. Like, he's got a very strong prey drive. And because he's a very passive dog with people, but he's an alpha with other dogs. He's not going to be walked all over by another dog. So I know that that can sometimes work against a dog in the training process, because if they feel the need to be dominant over tasking, that can kind of be at odds with the training. But those are all things that we'll explore. I will say that after seeing this massive change, and in the coming weeks, what may still continue to materialize, for any of you that are having what seems like an unending potty training situation, I would recommend you reach out to me. Specifically those who have had potty training issues with puppies lasting more than a year. Because this could be a deeper issue, and it could be something they may grow out of. Now, I had every vet that saw him tell me this was a dead-end road, at least without medical intervention surgically. And I'm here to tell you that this is resolving on its own. I have not done the surgery. I'm not saying this is going to be the case with everybody's dog, but often by questioning and cueing clients, I can tell where the problem is coming from, if it's a routine issue, if it could be a medical problem. And so if you're struggling and you have had this puppy since, you know, it was very, very young, and now you're a year, year and a half in, and you still haven't resolved a constant potty training problem, please contact me. You can email me if you heard earlier in the show at dogguruhereforyou@gmail.com. It's in the show notes, so you don't have to remember it. And I would be happy to help figure out what's going on, because now that I've always given out potty training advice. In fact, I have entire episodes devoted to potty training. But the reality is that there are other things that can cause problems with potty training. One of them is if you have an anxiety case. Another is a medical condition. You know, I had another client with a German Shepherd that for the first 2 years of its life lived in a hospital. He had every medical condition. He was abandoned by his mother. He had every medical condition under the sun, and he developed severe aggression. He was overprotective. All of his instincts were kind of muddled and on overdrive in other areas. And when I tell you this dog was overprotective, I mean, the first time I met him, he was barking not only when I got onto the property, but the owner was holding both arms with all of her weight against this dog, and he still looked like he was ready to go. I was too close for his comfort. Now, by the end of our sessions together, he was a different dog. And it only took five It wasn't a miracle. It's that she worked the process. And I continued working the process with my dog. I think if I had given up, whether or not his body caught up, the training wouldn't have been there in its entirety. So my advice is just not give in and give up so easily. This could be developmental. You know, especially if you have a large breed. My dog is a Newfoundland. I had amazing support from his breeder. And I was very open and honest with her the entire time. Could I have expected that he was going to start changing this last month? No. I hope that it sticks. I have a certain fear that despite the fact that he's doing better, he may still not be a service dog candidate because of the reasons I expressed earlier. But I will say, there is a misconception about service animals that you can't train a service dog that wasn't trained as a puppy and wasn't started as a puppy. In this case, the dog was started as a puppy, but I'm here to tell you, I have worked with clients whose dogs were not puppies, but were already keying into their owner's disabilities and made excellent service dogs. Many impulse behaviors or long-stemming behaviors can be counteracted by the right procedure. So if the owner knows what to do and why the dog is doing what they're doing, they often can stop it, change it, and eventually resolve it so it isn't the issue it is. And for that reason, I always have hope. And that German Shepherd I mentioned, I mean, I would have never expected he would have made the amount of shifts he made in as short of a time after being an orphan dog and having gone through all he did for the first 2 years. A big problem he had was he wasn't managed by mom. So there was a lot of language that was missed. And we're actually going to talk about that today because, you know, the early stages and imprint periods in dogs are really important to talk about. It's the why behind a lot of the behaviors we see later on. Not all behaviors. Some of them we put there ourselves. Some of them can happen from outside exterior free radicals, like outside experiences when you're out walking your dog, somebody else's dog runs up. Happened to my dog today. So things like that can happen. That said, your ultimate goal always has to be, how can I resolve this? Why is my dog doing this and how can I make it better? Okay, so if you go in with the thought that this isn't a problem, but it's just something that you need to find the right plan for, you may feel a little relief right away. Just because, you know, often we look very negatively at a dog's behavior. We don't really think about the why often enough. You know, if a dog starts going crazy, we're like, oh my God, I can't believe he acted like this. But then we never stop and ask ourselves, okay, well, why did he do that? And we need to start asking why. And there's a few things to consider. So the first is, what was the environment like when they were first whelped or born? And what it looked like in the first 6 to 8 weeks of their life. Very important, and I'll explain why in a second. The other important element is knowing what their current daily dynamic and environment look like. And the third piece is learning where their pain points are. So where do you see them react the most? Is it only when people come onto your property? Is it only on walks? Is it in 4 or 5 different arenas? You know, dogs don't generalize well, but sometimes one problem can surface in multiple areas. Not always to the same degree, but sometimes we see it in other areas. It kind of spills over. So those are the important things to first think about. Now, why is the first 6 to 8 weeks so important to take into account? Often you don't even have your dog at that time. The reason for that is because mom needs to send a lot of messages to puppies. Just like when you're teaching a young child how to read, how to walk, how to eat, all of the very basic things just to get along in life, you know, how to take care of themselves, what's acceptable, what's not. Their mom does that, including language, very early. So there's a few problems when you have an orphaned pup or a puppy that's been taken too early from mom. Sometimes you get a lack of language. So the dog doesn't actually know how to read other dogs' body language, verbal language. They don't know what the... It's almost like they're a foreigner. They have no idea what you're saying. They have no idea what message is being conveyed to them by another dog. And you would think, because they're a dog, they must just get it. Often that's not the case. There are what we refer to as imprint periods, and I mentioned that earlier. So imprint periods are very important to dogs. And the first is from birth to 8 weeks, and then the second is 8 to about 15 weeks. There is a third imprint period. I don't find those to be as relevant because the first two are the most crucial. That's where your dog learns what they're going to be afraid of, excited about, aggressive towards, dominant with, submissive with. All of those messages are sent right now in the first 6 weeks, actually. They learn it with their litter mates. They learn it from mom. You know, if you ever watch, you can go on YouTube right now and Google moms and puppies. And there are plenty of videos of what a mother dog will do if her puppies are acting up or annoying her. She often stands up, walks away, and ignores them. If they are, you know, nipping at her or being too aggressive with her, she very clearly growls at them and shows them a boundary. She doesn't go over the top, but she sends a very clear message. Now, what happens when those weeks or days are missing? Well, that language is missing. So then when we as humans come in and we're like, hey, why don't you get along with my other dog? Or why don't you get along fine at, you know, PetSmart? Or why are you having issues on a walk? Well, the reason is because they don't really have that language. They missed it. Now, I always recommend if you can, if you're getting a dog from a breeder, if you can wait 8 to 12 weeks, that's ideal, okay? Because any time they can have with their litter mates to develop and learn from mom, that's just really, really important time that you cannot undo. And they need. Now, there are some breeders that only keep their dogs till they're 8 weeks due to expenses and, you know, not wanting their house destroyed, those sorts of things. But all of that said, you know, ideally, you want at least one of the imprint periods to be over so that they've learned from mom and brothers and sisters how to behave. And if they are a singleton, that they'll at least learn from mom and have a home environment with you and some exposure. So that's important. Now, those dynamics, those social dynamics that they start developing with puppies, as puppies with their litter mates, is where they start learning who's going to be in charge, who's going to be more boisterous. You can see it very early on. If you look at a litter of puppies, most people who have a behavior background with animals will immediately be able to pick out the alpha and everybody in between. They'll be like, this is the one that's going to act like this, and this is the one that... And it won't be... It's not foolproof, but generally there are certain characteristics that you just recognize in an alpha or a dog that's going to be a little bit more passive. So, and it's another reason why breeders will hang on to puppies a little longer, because they want to see their personalities develop and make sure they're matched to an appropriate home instead of just willy-nilly, you know, selling them to whoever. Which is responsible breeding. Now, for those of you who have adopted a puppy, maybe you adopted it from, you know, an adoption event or the Humane Society, and this puppy is 6 weeks old. And you're like, well, I didn't even get a vote here. You know, the puppy is what the puppy is. I understand those situations occur, and that's why I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. So starting off, I've already explained there may be holes in the language that your dog knows. So how can you fill those holes in? Well, the first way is by making sure you have an open communication between you and your dog. Positive reinforcement training helps build a bond early, so that will make him or her more receptive to a new language, because there's affirmation, there's confirmation, there's confidence building, and all of those elements make the dog want. They want to work. They want to impress. They want to do better. They want to, you know, so if you start in a positive way, the dog responds positively. That has been my experience. Now, here's what kind of stinks about this situation. you can't now take your 6-week-old puppy anywhere as safely as you can once they've finished their shot series. So I caution you there. You kind of are missing a bit of a window, but you aren't in that you're still building a bond, starting the relationship in a positive way. So as your dog develops, they already crave that relationship. And from there, you can start, you know, planning a route. And the first thing I would do in this situation, especially if you have a younger dog, is even if it's just once, hire an in-home trainer to come and visit with you. And ask them to come to your home. I recommend this for a reason, because there's so much that goes on in a home that if you bring your dog to a group class, your trainer isn't going to know and see. And a lot of that can impact your dog and their behavior. So it's better if they get a chance to sit down with you and meet with you and answer all your questions right where they're cropping up. And maybe even set up a plan with you, not even necessarily a training plan, but a starting, this is what the environment needs to look like. This is what you need to do. No, the puppy seems emotionally pretty well-rounded. You know, you can end up with a 6-week-old puppy that's really just very laid back and responsive. Not all holes create negative responses. You know, I've had dogs that, you know, are just so passive that even though they were never trained, they don't have a mean bone in their body. I mean, there's just nothing behind it. So even though they had no manners, they just weren't abrasive either. So there are a few ways that this can go. So I'd recommend having a trainer come to your home. That's step one. Step two is doggy language. So there's already, we've established there are some holes here. So doggy language is important to establish. Don't do this at a dog park, because a lot of the dogs that are at a dog park are not socialized. That's not a place where you want your dog to learn. You want your dog to learn in a controlled space. So I recommend for this a group class, a positive reinforcement-based group class. Don't take your dog to a place where they're gonna, you know, scare them into doing the right thing. Because any response made out of fear is not actual acceptance. And I think that's an important point to make, because that's actually what can undo training later down the road or creates problems behaviorally between owner and dog. You know, you shouldn't have to overpower an animal to get the response you want. That's my opinion. It's not anecdotal, though, because there's plenty of scientific evidence to back it up. And we have learned that not, you know, when a dog is in a state of fear, learning is arrested. We've learned that. They literally shut down when they're afraid. And what do we fear? They fear the same things that we fear. They fear pain. They fear loss. They fear the severity of your reaction. And for me, I'd rather my dog be excited he's waking up next to me in the morning than, uh-oh, what am I messing up now? Let me make sure I'm in check. You know, I can always tell when a dog has gotten to a point where they're just overly alert mentally and overrun, because their eyes are almost, they will frequently freeze. They just, it's not even something the dog does intentionally. It's just they're always trying to manage emotionally. And it's basically them going, I don't know what's about to happen. Let me make sure I'm still in check. And when you think about it, that's really mentally taxing on a dog. So you're not going to get the best out of them. Whereas every dog I've ever worked with is so excited to impress their owners that it isn't work for them. It's essentially a giant game in a lot of ways. Is everything easy? No. But we've put them in a state of promotion where we're building them up instead of breaking them down. And because of that, we are going to make leaps and bounds of progress. It's why that German Shepherd, after having, she had 5 other trainers work with this dog before me. And when I walked through, I was the only person who could get the dog to calm down. The only person. And there were other trainers who had been in her house multiple times, and I did it in the first day. But I did it by gaining his trust. I did not take it over the top. I wasn't abrasive about my approach. And I showed him who I was and how I was going to present myself. And he could trust that. You know, I see too many people get heavy-handed with dogs, and so they get a very heavy response. You don't have to create a reactive dog, but you can. You know, it's just like taking, you know, food out of their mouth, or, you know, I just believe certain amounts of force just shouldn't be used. You know, sometimes taking something away that they enjoy, like the tennis ball, because they're jumping all over you, is enough to send the message that they shouldn't have been jumping on you. You know, it's all in what you use as your collateral. I don't use fear. I don't feel that fear ever gets the ultimate goal, which is the relationship. The dog often can obey, but when a dog obeys out of fear, you're not going to get the quickest response. You're always going to get a fraction of what the dog could have given you. And there is always another way. You know, even dogs that were previously trained improperly can do, you can do an overhaul with that dog. You know, just because you learned it one way or they learned it one way doesn't mean you can't undo that history. Many of my clients inherited dogs or adopted dogs that had been handled or mishandled by bad owners, poor training, and it happens. And so we have to, just like filling in language with puppies, we have to fill in the blanks. So make sure who you're working with is using positive reinforcement. So at least you're not adding insult to injury. You're not causing harm here. It's a very important thing. If you have a highly, you know, combative dog, you're going to need a one-on-one session. But often with young puppies, you don't see serious aggression. If you are, that's a deeper problem often, and it needs to be addressed right away. It's not that it never happens. It's just that you need to nip it in the bud really, really quickly. Really, really quickly if you see it in a very young dog. I'm not talking about a little growling or trying to guard a toy here and there. That's stuff you expect because it's them trying to establish dominance with you. It's very normal for them to test you. I'm talking about a dog being what I would describe to be easily triggered. Like every time you turn around, the dog could snap. That's not normal. At any age, if you feel like you can't trust your dog, you need exterior help. And again, I don't recommend pulling in a missile to fix a problem like that, because the missile is going to scare the dog. It might get you the result initially, and it'll give you that sense of peace initially, but it's really a false sense of security because you haven't actually resolved the issue or the underlying why. So that leads me to why dogs do what they do. Well, often it's us. Often the reason they do what they do is because we either haven't taught them an alternative, or we have essentially fostered the behaviors that we don't like. I'll give you an example. If you have a dog at home that you know is always going to jump on the furniture, and you don't want them jumping on the furniture, but when you see them on the furniture, you don't insist they get off, well, guess what? You're permitting the behavior. Another example, you're on a walk. Every time your dog sees a small dog, he wants to go for it. Well, you just walk a little further away. Are you addressing the problem? Are you diffusing the situation? Are you solving or resolving or in any way taking a proactive role? No, you're just walking by further away. So often we are the reason that the problems consistently exist that we don't like. Or they're just things that we thought were cute when they were younger and are not so cute when they're bigger. You know, like jumping was all fine and well when it was an 8-pound dog, but now that he's an 80-pound dog, okay, it's too big. He's knocking me over. He's wrecking my clothes. I can't get through the door. This is a real problem. So we have to go back and we have to think about what are we doing right now that is contributing to this problem? Okay, what is it that we are doing in our behavior? Forget the dog's behavior. What are we doing that contributes to it? When we're on a walk, we're walking further away. We're not at all confronting the issue. Not that I'm saying go over to the dog that your dog is trying to eat. What I am saying is we're not shutting down the behavior at all. We're not communicating at all. And in a situation like that, I would have required the dog to sit, make eye contact with me. If the dog is super reactive, I would not make the dog, you know, kind of look over and then check in with me. I would want full eye contact from the dog while the other dog passes safely at a safe distance, probably 10, 15 feet. I wouldn't take my dog. Maybe I would, you know, take them further away, but I wouldn't take them away. I'm not going to evacuate a scenario. Unless the other dog is off leash, I rarely ever did that. There are exceptions to the rule, like if you feel like your collar is about to break or you're getting overpowered by your dog, in which case you need to get out of there. The goal is not to see through every scenario. It's to make sure everyone is safe and that the dog is in a teachable state. So, you know, I'm going to go back to that scenario. Okay, so my dog, not my dog, but case in theory, okay, I see a small dog. I already am anticipating my dog reacting because I already know my dog reacts to small dogs, right? So if you know that going in, what should you be doing? Or what should you not be doing? The first thing you shouldn't be doing, should not be doing, is tightening up on your leash. Why? That consistently sends a message of stress to your dog. You're sending all of your stress right down that leash to your dog. Because they feel it. If you're tightening up on the leash, they feel it. If you're wrapping it around your arm, they feel it. If your heart is racing, they know it. There are so many signals that your dog is keying into that you think they're just completely ignoring because they seem so focused on another dog. So all of these things that are going on, you're going to have to take a deep breath and shut down. Okay? Take a deep breath and then ask your dog to sit. Now, if the dog that's coming to you isn't at a safe enough distance, take some steps further away at whatever distance. So keep them a good 15 feet, 20 feet, whatever you feel is comfortable. Let that other dog pass. You don't pass that dog. That dog needs to pass you. Why is this important? Well, it's really important for your dog not to feel like they can control a dynamic. They're used to passing. So however they act all the way up and all the way past has already been pretty much ingrained in them. We need to break that pattern. So by asking them to sit and requiring them to watch the other dog pass, now they can engage. It gives you more control over their physical self. So they're not all over the place. You don't have to hold back a freight train because they're already in an isolated position. So the worst you have to worry about is getting them back into a sit rather than them taking off from you. And then you have the added benefit of you're absorbing. Your dog is taking in this moment. And this is very different from what he's experienced in the past. You're going, wait. We're not going to keep bailing. We're not going to keep running past. We're not going to keep acting like this isn't an issue. And you've probably heard me mention a strong leave it and a strong cue for eye contact. I used look are invaluable. You're going to need them. So sit, look, leave it. Those are your primary cues that your dog absolutely needs. More than a strong heel, your dog needs these three. Because these are your tools to get them to a point where you can start closing that gap between you and a neighbor and their dog, start desensitizing your dog, and then you can work on passing without your dog promoting a message of being combative or aggressive. Because you've broken the chain of events, you've taught the dog to do something else, the dog learns that the dog passing never comes to eat them, that they don't get to eat the other dog. So there's a whole dynamic that occurs that's very different than before. Whereas when you just pass each other, everything that your dog was doing, growling, pulling, scraping at the ground, blowing their cheeks, their hackles are up, whatever they're doing that's sending a message that they want at the other dog, none of that is now happening. You've just taken all of that away. And over time with your dog, you'll notice when your dog starts relaxing with this process and when it's time to start working on passing, because your dog won't care that the other dogs are passing. That's how you know you've gotten through. If your dog is still fidgeting and can't hold eye contact with you or is still overly focused on the other dog, you're not ready to move to stage two. So until your dog is completely calm with any dog passing them in a sit position, you're not ready to pass them if they have any inclination towards an anxiety-based response or an aggressive response. You need to break the cycle. So that's one of the biggest whys behind dogs doing what they do. It's us. It's the things that we allow. It's the things that we don't do. And it's the environment we keep them in. So now let's think about this. How often are you home during the day? Are you? When you come home, how much of that time is given to your dog? Do you have any one-on-one time with your dog? Do you ever work on training with your dog, even for 10 or 15 minutes? What amount of time is devoted to resolving the sorts of things that you consider undesirable behaviors? You need to ask yourself these questions, because a lot of this will start shaping how you change what you need to change going forward. And your dog will change accordingly. You know, if we change our behavior and the environment in which they live, they have no other choice but to then amend their behaviors. They're codependent in that we have structured them and domesticated them to a level where they want a relationship with us. So now we need to take inventory of what we are doing as individuals that are acting into the behaviors we don't like, and then start changing those. And maybe we don't know. Maybe we don't know what to change. And that's when professionals are of the most use. I don't think there's any shame in ever reaching out to a professional. That's one of the reasons why I'm now doing sessions, is because a lot of you have written in and you do have very specific cases. A lot of you have worked with other trainers and you need specific advice. And I understand that. You need somebody who you can trust, somebody who knows what you're talking about. And while I may not get to meet your dog in person and have every piece of the puzzle, I'm going to do my best to assist you in a way that maybe a trainer hasn't. I think differently than some behaviorists and some trainers do. And it's because of where my background is. You know, I feel that a lot of behaviors are psychologically based. So I handled them with a psychological approach. And I feel that in the history of successes that my clients have had and the lack of flare-ups they had after the fact is really indicative that it works for them, that it was manageable for them. Because, you know, not all training is manageable for everyone. You know, if you told me I had to work with my dog 6 hours a day, I'd be like, oh my God. And I have a service dog. So I'm here to tell you, it doesn't take 6 hours a day to train your dog, but it does take consistency. It does take commitment. And sometimes, as was the case with my dog, sometimes you have to wait out development. You know, he's a year and a half now, and I feel like he's just starting life now. You know, he's always been a nice dog, but now I see, it's almost like I just adopted a year and a half year old dog, because it's now where we're really going to see his personality fully develop. It's now that we're going to find out what holes we really truly need to fill in, because now he's a little bit more boisterous. Now he's got more energy. Now he's got more bone and muscle and weight. I mean, he's doing more because he is more. So all of these things play into the why. And that actually, the medical component could be at play here too. If you feel like you've been hitting a wall and you've worked with trainers and you don't know why your dog is consistently reacting, especially if it's an aggressive response, I would definitely do a full workup at a vet. Make sure there's nothing biochemically that's going on and contributing to your issue here. Because dogs sometimes behave in an aggressive fashion or show more anxiety when they're in pain or something medically is going on and disrupting their system. So food for thought there. The other why that we need to take into account is genetics. So now I will not tell you that every dog, because it's a certain breed, is going to behave a certain way, but I will tell you that characteristically, there are behaviors that are bred into dogs that we don't breed out. And also, there are characteristics that breeders will retain, things like size, personality type, health, you know, things that they want to promote in their line. So now, why is this important? Well, even if you didn't get your dog from a breeder and you adopted your dog, genetics do play a role in who they are. It doesn't determine who they will be, but it plays a role in some of the things that you run into. For example, if you have a Jack Russell, you're probably used to barking. If you have a German Shepherd, you may have a dog that bristles up when it sees a stranger. If you have a Karen Terrier, you may have a dog that's obsessed with chasing things. Or if you have a Greyhound, you may have a dog that has a very strong prey drive. So there are lots of things that are characteristic traits of a breed. And this is important to take into account. Now, if you have a mix, you may not know what mix of dogs your dog is, and that's fine. And maybe this is one element you can't really deeply explore. I don't recommend you bother with these tests, this genetic testing to find out what your dog is. There's a few reasons for that, but not to ruin another surprise, a lot of breeds that we have are not included. So when they do the test, you know, a ton of European and foreign breeds aren't even taken into account. And that's where we got a lot of the breeds that we have. So to me, it's all for naught right now. That's my opinion. That said, if you did get your dog from a breeder, if you have a lab, you probably have a dog that's got a desire to retrieve, that's probably dropped a few tennis balls in your lap, that has a little bit more energy than, say, a St. Bernard. Now, if you have a St. Bernard, you have a dog with a very strong work ethic. He might be a huge couch potato sometimes, but you better give him a job because they like to do things. So, and Newfoundlands, I have a Newfoundland I mentioned, and Baldur has always had a strong work ethic. He has continued to signal and offer my medical alerts, despite the fact that I never thought this was going to get to this point. I never really thought that he might even be a possible candidate after this past year. But despite all of that, he continued signaling. He interrupts the behaviors, he tasks consistently. And I really attribute a lot of that to the fact he's a working breed. They love to work. They love their families. They're very loyal. He has the guarding instinct in that he doesn't want anybody to just show up willy-nilly on my property, but he's so nice that in public he's not showing that level of abrasiveness. But it's something I'm going to have to work on. Like, have I ever seen him bark at a stranger? Yeah, I have. At night, he will. So that's going to be an issue if I ever wanted to have him work at night, which obviously I would. So I'm taking into account not only his current state and some holes I know I'm going to have to fill in, but also who he is and what he naturally wants to do. If you have a dog that's a working breed, 9 times out of 10, you can change their behavior to your credit. Like, it'll work in your favor because they'd rather be working your plan. Australian Shepherds are a great example of this. Any breed, like Border Collies or another breed that are really, they love to work for their owners. They love to impress their owners. And sometimes they don't even want the treat. They just want a hug. So, you know, for working breeds, you kind of luck out in that as long as you give them the job, they're happy. But if you don't give them the job, they'll make a job. And sometimes the house is the job, and destroying the house or digging in the yard or barking at a butterfly going by. You know, it could be any number of things that they do for their own entertainment because they haven't been given enough stimulation. So you need to take into account who your dog is. I will say that there are scenarios, and this is not every scenario, but there are certain cases where you may have taken on a dog whose needs are more than you expected. And here's the good and bad news. The good news is you can do something about that. The bad news is it's not going to change. His need is not going to change. I'll give you an example of this. Vizslas are really, really smart dogs. Wonderful dogs. They have a ton of energy. They can cover a ton of ground. And why is this? They're a hunting breed. They are programmed, hardwired to do their job. And because we haven't overbred them, they tend to do their job still. You know, there are some dogs that we have bred them so many times and have so many generations, we've almost watered down what their original purpose was. Case in point with a Vizsla, that's, we haven't gotten there yet. We have not watered down that breed. They still have just as much energy, they are just as intelligent, and they are just as motivated to do their job. But I had a client where their dog had absolutely destroyed their house. They called me because they weren't sure what they were going to do. And the dog was just, I mean, they couldn't even catch him because he was so fast in their house. I mean, he was like having a gazelle in their home. And there were a lot of challenges with this dog just, you know, battling with his energy. And they also had him on a very high crude protein diet, which we had to change because it was definitely adding to some of the high energy he had. It took him down a notch, not a lot by a diet change, but a little, where he could focus a little bit. But the owner was having issues catching the dog. In the yard, he would just round and round and round and just sniff and just would not stop. And I said, he's doing his job. He needs an outlet. He needs to do his job. And they were working all day. And so, you know, it wasn't the ideal scenario for the dog. And I was very honest with them. I was like, for this to work, this dog is going to need interaction. I developed a training plan for this dog that included an exercise plan, that included an outlet every week for him to go into like a nature preserve with the owner and explore and start using some of his natural instincts that he just really needed an outlet for. And I started telling them, you know, you have to have him start earning the things that he's been just permitted to have. I mean, he was all over the place. And you could tell that when he was a puppy, this was all cute and not a big deal. But now that he was, you know, 40, 50 pounds, I mean, it wasn't cute anymore. He was huge for them. And it's very important to take into account, if I wouldn't want the dog doing this when they're 80 pounds, or if the dog were 80 pounds, don't accept it when they're a puppy. Work on it then, because problems only grow if they're not addressed. But yeah, another why is genetics, because it's the basis of who your dog is. And then the other why I just made reference to, and that's diet. So diet plays a very, very big role in what your dog is going to look like. And what I mean by that, I mean how much energy they're going to have, how much they're going to be able to focus. Because think about it, as the food breaks down in their system, if it creates more sugar, they're going to be bouncing off the walls like Mexican jumping beans. But if they're on a healthy diet that doesn't have an insane crude protein level, and they are getting the exercise that they need, then you see a shift in behavior and focus. And you also see overall they get healthier. Because, you know, when you just have a bunch of fillers in your dog's food, you're really not, they're not getting the best of it and you're not getting the best of them. Diet plays a very large role in who your dog is. And I think this is one of the things that's really overlooked and or isn't looked into enough. So start taking into account your dog's diet. Start, you know, flipping over your bag of dog food and taking a good look at what they're actually eating every day. You know, you want to stay away from chicken meal and making sure that grains are your fillers. Your dog needs a balanced diet. And that doesn't mean that it's completely grain free. It means that there's a difference between good grains and bad grains. Brown rice, for example, is a good grain. As far as crude protein level, I like anywhere from 20 to 23% at the very most. A lot of dog foods that are out there right now are like 27 to 32%, which is just unreal. It's way too much. When it breaks down, it basically becomes sugar in their system, so it gives them a great deal more energy than they need and or can express. So sometimes they'll start becoming destructive, or they become like more energetic at home and you can't seem to get a handle on them. Often diet plays a role in how much energy and output your dog actually has. Some of it's genetics, but some of it's food. So I hope that is helpful in discovering some of the why behind what your dog is doing, thinking, feeling, and what you can do about it. But if it doesn't answer all your questions and you would like to have a one-on-one session with me, please email me at dogguruhereforyou@gmail.com. Again, it's in the show notes. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate us wherever you're listening to us. And please share us with all your friends and family. Perhaps we can help them with their doggy issues. and help promote peace and hope in their home with their canines. Last but not least, if you love the show and you'd like to donate, you can do so at paypal.me/yourdogguru. That's paypal.me/yourdogguru. I would definitely appreciate it. That's it for me today, everybody. This has been Victoria, your dog guru. Namaste.
You've been listening to a Blazing Caribou Studios production. Support and subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/blazingcariboustudios.